Hey there, I'm Tal Zlotnitsky from Ignite IT Consulting. You know me from the Braving Business podcast, but when I'm not behind the mic, I'm helping tech startups and established companies ignite their full potential. I also help entrepreneurs and businesses in distress reset for success. With over three decades of entrepreneurial success, I bring hands-on experience to drive growth, navigate turnarounds, raise capital, and lead through innovation. Whether it's executive coaching or strategic transformation, I'm here to turn your business challenges into success stories. Visit igniteitconsulting.com and let's spark that change together. That's igniteitconsulting.com. Your journey to business brilliance starts now.
And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
Hi, handsome. How are you?
Thank you, handsome. How are you?
Very good.
I'm devastatingly
I'm excited to talk to our guest today.
Oh my gosh.
And still sort of reeling from the television I was watching last night. I'm just trying to process what I'm seeing over here.
Oh, pray tell. What was that?
Yeah. Well, I'm not proud of it, but Aaron and I are watching Love is Blind, and it's a really interesting show. Actually, we really loved the exposure to how people interact with significant others and how they are in relationships. We think it's actually, there's a lot to learn from it, but there's a really, really odd, and I think terribly disagreeable part to this series, which is that the individuals who make it all the way to the end of the show need to go up to the altar and then in front of their families decide whether or not they're getting married.
Oh gosh.
And I have watched two horrific instances of people who believed and expected the other party to say, I do, say I don't. Oh. It was unbelievable. I cannot imagine. Can you imagine, Shelley, like being, I mean, you're up at the altar, your family's there, you're dressed to be married, and someone says no?
No, I personally just think that's abuse.
It is, right?
It is.
It's pure abuse. Why would you set somebody up like that you must have cared enough about to have gotten to that point? I don't understand right? that at all.
It's horrible. And we were speculating whether it's in their contracts that they can't tell the other person that they are backing up. I don't know. Anyway, PJ, that's what's up. But let's turn our attention to a far more valuable usage of our guests
of our time, absolutely.
Our audience's time.
Would you mind if I introduce Miss Shelley Archambault? Is that okay?
I would not mind at all. I insist, as a matter of fact.
Well, you know why? Because she is a trailblazing technology leader and an icon in the business world with a track record as long as my arm. It's small on screen, but you know, it's kind of long.
It's a very long arm.
Thank you. She started her career at IBM and showing ambition from the start and having learned that many CEOs had previously worked in sales, she started her career at IBM in a sales role and eventually became the first African-American woman in IBM history to be sent on an international assignment. I'm going to dig into that. After 15 years at IBM, Shelley was recruited by Blockbuster to become the president of the company's e-commerce division, where she launched the entertainment retailer's first online presence. And I'm sure there's a lot that we're going to learn from that story as well. She went on to become one of the first female African-American CEOs in the high-tech industry in Silicon Valley as CEO of governance, risk, compliance, and compliance software for the software company MetricStream. She built that company into a global market leader. And under Shelley's leadership, MetricStream was named to the top 10 of the hugely prestigious Deloitte Technology Fast 50 list. I wanted to say that correctly.
Say that fast five times.
Yeah, I know. I'm all over the place today. As well as she was named a global leader within its sector for 9 consecutive years. Shelley currently serves on the boards of publicly traded companies such as Verizon, Nordstrom, Roper Technologies, and Okta. And she is also a strategic advisor to Forbes Ignite and to the president of the Arizona State University. And she also serves on the boards of 2 national nonprofits, Catalyst and Braven. Since 2020.
And she's about to start another nonprofit that we're going to hear about today.
Absolutely. She's going to ignite it, as you know. Since 2020, she has been dedicating a lot of her time and attention to inspiring others to achieve their dreams and aspirations. Her book, Unapologetically Ambitious, which was named a best business book by both Fortune and Bloomberg when published in 2020, and is still available everywhere you buy books, is in part a memoir about her time as a, quote, young Black woman, wife, and mother climbing up the ranks. It is also a how-to book for strivers, exploring some themes that we've talked about here on the podcast, such as imposter syndrome, risk-taking, building our network, the value of mentorship, and the criticality of building the right reputation. We look forward to hearing her take on these and more. Miss Shelley Archambeau, thank you for joining us on the Braving Business Podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to the conversation.
Us as well. This definitely ranks as a highlight to have you on the show. There's so much I want to ask you, and I hope we'll be able to fit it all in the time we have. But let's start at the beginning. I always ask our guests, one of the first questions that I ask is how you got to where you got. You have a truly inspirational, almost incredible story. It honestly, as PJ was talking about the fact that you were the first African-American woman to be sent on assignment by IBM, it almost feels like something from a different, it's an altogether different era. I mean, it's impressive and yet shocking, like beyond belief.
Yeah.
I'd love to have you take us back to the beginning. What were some early influences and some early decisions that led you to the life path you ultimately chose?
Sure. So, you know, early lessons and early experiences. Well, honestly, you know, it was one of those things where I figured out very early that the odds were just not in my favor. I grew up in education-wise, elementary school in the 60s. And in the 60s, you had a lot of people that felt civil rights should be happening, but frankly, you had just as many that felt it shouldn't be happening. And so as a little Black girl being moved all over the country, my father didn't have a college degree, so we moved every time he got a new opportunity. I was 7 different states before I got to high school, right? So you're always the new kid. And they felt education was very important for us. So we moved to the best school district they could possibly move to, which meant people didn't usually look like me. I was usually one of the only Black kids or the only Black kid. And so people let me know they didn't think I belonged. I got bullied. I was beat up. It was terrible. But, you know, you come home from school and you say, mom, you know, this happened. Somebody pushed me down. They did this, whatever. You know, it's not fair. And my mother's response was always, Shelley, life's not fair. Well, I have to tell you, as a kid, life's supposed to be fair. I mean, you get a lollipop, I get a lollipop. You get a turn, I get a turn. What do you mean it's not fair? But it was always, it's not fair. And then when she would also add to that, don't let them win. And what she meant by that was, you can't control what people say to you because they said some pretty nasty things. And you can't control what they do to you. And they did some pretty terrible things to me too. But you can control how you respond. So don't let them win. They win if they cause you to change how you feel about yourself or change what you want to do. Then they win. So don't let them win. So with that as a backdrop, I became very intentional. I knew the odds weren't in my favor. I couldn't let them win, which means I needed to do what I wanted to do. So fast forward, I'm in that junior year in high school, you know, the obligatory conversation with the high school guidance counselor. Do you want to go to college? He said, yes, college. What do you want to do after college? And I said, I don't know what I want to do after college. I just know I want to earn enough money to be able to keep my thermostat at 72 degrees in the wintertime. I wanted to be able to eat out in restaurants, and I wanted to be able to travel because those were all the things I couldn't do. And she laughed and then realized that I was dead serious. And she said, well, Shelley, what do you like to do? And for this, I give her incredible credit because I said, oh, that's easy. Clubs. I'm in everything. American Field Service, National Honor Society, French Club. I'm even a Girl Scout, but you know, don't tell anybody because it's not cool. And I like to run them, right? Like to run them. So she said, well, you know, clubs are like business. You pull people together and you get things done. And I said, perfect. I'm going to go into business. And you know what? I like running these clubs. So I'll go run a business. And when I looked up, those people were called CEOs. So at the ripe old age of 16, I decided I'm going to be a CEO. Nice. It was that audacious and that naive, because did I have any idea what that really meant? No, but But now I had a goal, so I was going to be intentional and go after it.
That's amazing. That is amazing. So to be that young and to say, like, did you have, you know, you're like, I want to be a CEO, which is great. Did you know, or did you have an idea of how much it took for you to get to where you eventually ended up?
Or honestly, even what it was, what did it mean to be a CEO?
Yeah,
exactly. Honestly, right. I just like it. It means running clubs, right? So it means, okay, I like leading clubs. So that's what it meant. So did I know what it meant? No. All right. I really didn't. But back to the odds are in my favor. So one of the things that I've always done, and I don't even know what age I started doing this, but it was, okay, so now I want to be a CEO. Fine. What has to be true for me to be a CEO? I had no idea. I had no idea. So I had to go do the research, which back then was hard. We're talking, this is the 70s now at the point. So it's like, okay, good library. Well, bottom line is I didn't see people, CEOs that look like me. So, okay, back to odds aren't in my favor. And they all, came from good colleges, right? They traveled, they this, that, and the other. So I said, fine, I've got to go to the best school I can possibly go to for business, improve my odds. I've got to join an industry that's growing, because I heard along the way, if you pick industries that are growing to build your career, companies in those industries are growing, and companies that are growing fast never have enough resources. So if you're good at what you do, you get more opportunities faster. So I was like, okay. So I looked around. Tech was the new hot thing that was coming along. So I said, great. I'm going to go be a CEO of a tech company. And so I applied to Wharton. They have an undergraduate program. So this was my fast path through. I'm like, great. I'll do Wharton undergrad. So I don't have to go to grad school, save the money, the whole bit. It's the only school I applied to. I literally wrote at the bottom, I want to be a CEO. This is the only school I want to attend. Please take me. Now the good news is I was a really good student. So I got into Wharton, and while I was there, I majored in business. So it was economics, marketing, decision science, but I took computer skills because I'm like, I want to increase my odds to get a job in the computer business. And IBM was the leader. So I said, okay, I'll go be CEO of IBM. And that's why I started out in sales, because I'd done the research and every single CEO at IBM started out in sales. So I said, okay. That must be the path to power. I mean, did I love sales? No, I didn't even know what that really meant. Just, okay, fine.
Very few people actually love sales, right? So let's talk about that. You've actually written and you've spoken about the challenges that you faced as a young woman climbing the corporate ladder at IBM. Mm-hmm. What were some of those challenges? And what was it like to be you? What was going through your head as you were there? Did you expect to run into some of these challenges? Was it, given your life experiences, was it sort of a known thing that you, as you were experiencing it, you're like, okay, I knew this was going to happen, and now here's my plan? Or did you run into it and were shocked anew every time that these things were happening to you?
Oh, no, I wish I could have said that I had clairvoyancy and knew that all these things were going to happen. I mean, the first thing that happened is because I wanted a career and I wanted to be CEO, but frankly, I also wanted to be married and have kids. So I got married right out of college and joined IBM and promptly got pregnant. So I went on quota pregnant in Dallas, Texas in the early 80s. So my big customer was Southland Corporation. They owned all the 7-Eleven stores. And you walk in and all the executives are wearing suits and cowboy boots and they're calling me sweetheart and honey and sweet pea and all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, oh my God, how am I ever going to sell anything if they don't even take me seriously? Now, when you say, did you expect all that? The answer is no, I didn't expect all that. But I had to learn how to garner respect in a way that didn't either anger people or embarrass people or, all of that. Because if you did that, they wouldn't want to buy from you. So that was probably one of the biggest learnings. And I tell people all the time, the best way to do it is to just be straightforward, but kind, and don't embarrass people. So for instance, I was sitting in a customer executive's office and somebody's looking for me. So he gets a phone call and he says, oh, hold on a minute. Sweet Pea is right here. Sweet Pea. All right. And he goes to hand me the phone. And I took the phone, but I put my hand over the receiver. And I said, his name was Mac McElroy. I mean, you can't make this up. And I said, Mac, my name is Shelley. And then I took the call. And I said nothing else about it, right? That's all I just said. Mac, just enough for him to pause to hear me. My name is Shelley. And then I took the call. So I didn't embarrass him. And you know what? He only called me Shelley from that point on. So it's important, right, to make sure that throughout that you're standing up for yourself, but in a way that people can receive it. That was a huge learning because trust me, microaggressions and all those little things happen all the time.
Yeah, you know, PJ, that makes me think of a concept that we've spoken about a lot, which is the importance of kindness. And it's and we've even talked about it in the context of almost love, Shelley. Love shouldn't be a foreign concept in business. And it's expressed in different ways. We're not talking about the same sort of love you'd express to your child or your spouse. It's frankly love expressed as respect. And you're going to run into opportunities to either behave well or behave badly. And the higher you rise up the ranks, the more opportunities you have to behave badly and not be called out on it. And one of the challenges that leadership provokes is the challenge of staying mindful of your impact on other people through what they hear you say and how they hear you say it. This isn't necessarily an easy lesson, nor is it a lesson that most people discover as early as you apparently did. I have to admit, it took me decades of being a CEO in environments that felt high stress with big investors and lots of money. And I gave myself permission to behave badly. It took a while for me to realize I can accomplish what I want to accomplish and feel better about myself by treating people with respect at all times, regardless of whether I feel that my aggravation gives me some sort of license. You never have that license. And if you take that license, just know you're actually diminishing the other person's humanity and you shouldn't. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, so true. The other piece I would add to that is there's power in giving people the benefit of the doubt. When he was calling me Sweet Pea, he wasn't trying to say, well, I'm going to call you Sweet Pea and make you feel demeaned, right? I mean, that's not what he's thinking. I'm sure, again, habit, right? Women, girls, you call them this, you call them that. I mean, so if you give people the benefit of the doubt, you'll be surprised pleasantly most times at their ability and willingness to actually rise up because they're just not aware of how it's received.
Oh, that's very insightful. Love that. So, you know, you ended up being recruited at a time or at that time, which I believe was the biggest name in home entertainment, Blockbuster. And Tao, you have some ties with Blockbuster, right?
I do. As a matter of fact, I was a CEO of a media distribution company and Blockbuster was a client of mine. Actually, the CEO that I work with there was Jim Keys. I don't know if he was if he was there at the same time that you were there, former 7-Eleven CEO, where I did business with him there, and then he went to the Blockbuster and the relationship carried on. So it's very interesting that we have that connection.
Sure is. Yeah, that John Aniaco was the CEO at the time.
Got it.
When I was there. Indeed.
So So when you're in this pool of dominant market leaders, but sometimes they seem like they move too slowly or that they're protective of these old paradigms, and eventually they kind of squander the dominance that they once held in the market. What was it like to be inside Blockbuster during those crucial years? And what lessons did it teach you that you think our audience can benefit from?
So I was at Blockbuster in the late 90s. And in the late 90s, Blockbuster was the behemoth. Mm-hmm. They had a store within 3 miles of like 85% of Americans. They printed cash. It was pretty amazing. And then there's this little upstart called Netflix. And Reed Hastings, the founder, and I met each other at conferences, et cetera. I was trying to build technology at Blockbuster to build up blockbuster.com. He had technology and was trying to create relationships with the media companies like you ran, right, et cetera, to be able to get content, to be able to drive his business. So we talked a few times. He came out to Blockbuster and pitched, let's take blockbuster.com, the brand, Netflix, the technology, put them together and go conquer the world, right? I'm summarizing very simply, but that was the idea. And my boss looked at that and said, why would I do that? If it turns into anything, we'll just buy it then, right? So passed on Netflix. And I left 6 months later. So what do you learn from that? Two things. One, what got you here won't get you there, right? What made Blockbuster Blockbuster was the fact they changed the business model for how media was frankly purchased from the distributors. They could have huge amounts of inventory to be able to offer out to clients via stores. Wonderful. Business models need to constantly evolve because consumers constantly evolve in terms of their needs. So if you make all of your decisions based upon the models that worked in the past, and you aren't willing to look at new models, consider new things, make sure you're following where the trends are going, you're going to get stuck and you're going to get left behind. Blockbuster is no longer, right? Blockbuster is no longer. So what got you here won't get you there.
Let's dig deeper into that, because while I absolutely agree with you, there's no question about it. That is a true statement. What got you here won't get you there. The reality is inside the boardroom and in the CEO suite and in the halls of companies that are in dominant market position, there is a bit of what I would call the Titanic before it sank mindset. It'll never happen to us.
Right.
Okay. We're going to get in front of it. We're going to buy it. Let's talk. I mean, while the concept is true, how do you translate that? I mean, the reality of humans, particularly humans who have found themselves at the top of the food chain in their positions and in a company that's in a dominant market position, is to feel invincible. How do you factor that into that equation where ultimately you're right, you do have to innovate, you have to be willing to shift. And many companies, Blockbuster's just one, how about Kodak, right? They actually had digital cameras before anyone else did, but they refused to put it out because the film business was their most profitable business. How do you actually make that happen in an organization?
Yeah, so it takes a couple of things. So one, I think it's important to look at 5 to 10% of, you know, resource time is actually spent on future, not the economics of what delivers the current plan, but what's going to deliver future, right? Revenue. So when you do that and you actually carve out a focus, you get attention, right? And you get learnings. Very few companies actually do that all the time. You know, some do, which is great. So that's one. Actually carve out resources whose focus is, if you will, the overall future. The second is, it's better to eat your own children than it is to let somebody else do it. All right. It just flat out.
Never knew we'd get to cannibalism, PJ, but it just finally happened.
Here we are.
I knew it would happen eventually. I wouldn't have imagined this episode would have been it.
I know.
We are. Carry on, Shelley. Tell us about eating our children.
There you go. But it's true. It is so true. Because here's what happens. If you realize that that's what's happening, right? You can control the dynamic and things if you're actually engaged versus closing your eyes and la, 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 right? It's not going to happen. So that's the other thing just to realize. But the key is, here's the real key. The real key is making sure that as a business, you fall in love, not with your products, not with your offerings, but you fall in love with your target markets that you're going after. If you fall in love with that market, you're going to want to do everything possible to take care of that market, to understand all of its needs. Where's it going? To anticipate. Think of your baby, right? When you have a baby, you are unconditionally in love with this baby. And you are trying to think of what does it need? Not just now, but what does it need later? What can I do now to help it grow and be amazing and terrific and right? All those things. Well, if you can treat your target market that you're going after that way, then you tend not to fall into the challenge of actually staying in old models and in old paradigms, because you were trying to anticipate where's it going, what's it going to need, and then can I provide what's required in the future?
With all this talk about babies, now you're making me hungry. So
I'm never going to live this down.
Well, you know, but no, it's actually kind of awesome. But I see the theme though. Of everything that you're saying is kind of following the same advice that you got when you were young, which is you can't always control the consequences or the situations, but you control how you react to them. And I think that having that step back away from the situation, right? Because you can't see the forest for the trees. So you're kind of like removing yourself a level and then being able to see everything in a broader scope, I think is what really assist you in getting to the goals that you want to get to. Is that a fair statement?
That is definitely a fair statement. And the other thing that I would add to that, because it's hard when you're running a company, it's all consuming. And you know everything, right, about this company. But what's really important is to make sure that you also are spending time outside of your company, that you are establishing relationships with people who can truly be good advisors or provide good perspectives on what's happening from an industry perspective or a technology perspective or whatever is related, right, to the space that you were in, to get that outside view. That was something I frankly learned later in my career versus earlier. Fortunately, before I became CEO. But before that, I always thought the people I should talk to are the people in my company. I worked for big companies. They were great people within the companies. And that was my network. It wasn't until after I left IBM that I realized the value of truly building an external network of people who could be the advisors, the challengers, right? The people that you could go to bounce ideas off, et cetera, so that you could get a broader view on where your market is going, on what's happening with the industry, on what's going on with the economy and global politics, whatever it might be.
And you know, just to
go ahead.
Thank you. I'm going to add one super quick thing. Just because I was talking to a CEO this morning, kind of consulting him on this very topic, and that was that he was so immersed in his company that not only your external network that you're talking about is super important, right? Your peers and people who can challenge you and poke holes in whatever fanciful ideas you may have for the future, but also your family and making sure that that network, that familial network, is also always attended to, because it's easy to get lost. Just like you're saying, it's very easy to get lost in your business. And if you don't attend to your family and you don't attend to, you know, he has small kids. If you don't attend to those small kids, eventually they're not going to be small anymore and you're going to be missing out. So you have to balance that as best as you can. It's a hard thing to do, but you still have to do it, because at the end of the day, those relationships are super important as well.
Absolutely. But I have to tell you, PJ, I don't like the term balance, work-life balance. Mm. And let me explain why.
Please.
What's balance? A balance is like a fixed structure, right? It's got a bar, thing across the top, two weights on each side that are even at all times. It's static. Whose life is static? Not mine, not yours. Nobody I know has a static life. So we're trying to hold something in balance while life is doing this. I think that's kind of crazy. We have enough things to feel guilty about. It's not about being even. It's all about getting done what needs to get done personally and professionally. So I believe in integration. You put those two things together and now you prioritize ruthlessly. And that's the key, ruthlessly, so that you get done what's really important across your life. Work, personal, across the life. And what that means is going to be some things probably not going to be able to get done. So either figure out somebody else to do them or decide that you can live without them getting done. But if you balance back and forth and back and forth, tens are, you may not actually get priorities done. So integrate. Sometimes that means you spend more time on the personal. Sometimes it's more time on the professional, right? I mean, it's going to ebb and flow, but that's okay. Integrate.
I love this.
It's very interesting. I actually really hear you there. We've actually talked about the fact that it's really not a work-life balance. It's really a life-work balance. And that doesn't mean you prioritize life over work. It means you prioritize mindfulness over anything, being aware of whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish. And I think that ties into what you're saying. Ultimately, it's not about just putting in the exact same number of hours or the exact same amount of effort. It's about being mindful no matter what it is that you choose. And I think for a lot of people, particularly entrepreneurs, particularly early on in their careers, that mindfulness is missing. They're sort of single-mindedly about pursuing something. Oftentimes it's necessary. I mean, I hate to say it. If I had not approached my career the way that I did my early years, I don't know that I would have achieved what I achieved. My kids are now adults. They tell me I was plenty present and I was fine. I feel a little bit of guilt about it, but ultimately I have to be realistic. Had I not traveled as much as I had, I not chosen what I chose to do, who knows what I would have accomplished. So I think it is sometimes easier to talk about work-life balance after the fact when you're not in the trenches. But I want to go back. This topic is so fascinating to me because I think that I really feel that what you said was correct. I forget the part about eating your children, but the reality is you talked about needing to be receptive to change agents. And I think in big companies in particular, there are the people that oftentimes get promoted are the people that put, if you will, points on the board now. And there's less attention being paid to those who might tell you what might happen later. And one question that as a CEO, I would encourage any CEO that's listening or anyone that aspires to be CEO is ask your direct reports, what is going to change? Don't tell me where we are. As we're talking about the future, tell me what you anticipate changing and how are we going to react to that? And incorporate that into their everyday lives. You might find that that saves your business one day if you do it that way. And I do think a CEO does need to, as much as possible, show that in their own actions. And that does oftentimes include going outside the company. So I think you and I are 100% aligned. But let's talk about, you know, you went on to become a CEO in Silicon Valley. Like you said, fortunately for you, you had had some of these lessons by then. Obviously, PJ cited the incredible accomplishments that you had at that company and that the company had, but I really want to go behind the scenes and I want to hear the story of your experience, right? You went to this company, you grew it into a global leader. It wasn't when you came there. You ended up with, I think, 1,200 employees. That's not where you started. There were moments of struggle. There were important decisions that needed to be made that were not obvious. What was going through your mind? And I want to tie that to a concept you talked about in your book, which is imposter syndrome. How much did you feel you were actually qualified to make the big decisions that, frankly, ended up dramatically changing the future of that company?
Well, first of all, imposter syndrome is something I've faced kind of throughout my career, and definitely as CEO, it didn't go away. I have to understand that when I took over as CEO of this company was very broken. They were literally on their way out of business. They were bringing me in as kind of the last Hail Mary. Like, this didn't work. This company wasn't going to make it. They were burning money like crazy. Hadn't sold anything new, right, in a while. The market they thought they had was disappearing. It was all of that. So when I first got there, it's like, yes, I'm finally CEO. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm the CEO.
So it was finally CEO
of a dumpster fire.
Exactly. Like, oh my gosh. So the first thing we had to do was to stop bleeding, right? So it was a lot of, okay, got to cut some costs, got to make hard decisions, et cetera. And then we've got to find a problem that we can solve with the technology that's been built. Because bottom line, that's all a business does. You solve problems for people. So we didn't have a problem that we were solving that anybody really cared about.
So that's the business, and I get that. And I know you guys solve the problems, and there's a lot of we there. I want to hear about you. What was your experience like? You're walking in the door, you're a new CEO. You've been president of Blockbuster.com, but this is probably the biggest assignment of your life. And like you said, potentially the company's on its way to failure. What did it feel like inside your head? What did your days look like?
Sure. My days were long. They were stressful. It was trying to figure out, how do I fix this company and bring the people that I need to stay along? Because as I said, the company wasn't doing well. So people are leaving. I need to figure out how to keep people that I want, right? Okay, how to solve the financial envelope, how to find a problem we can solve, and who can I trust, right? And who's going to be good? It was all of that. So every day was walking into another, oh my God, kind of moment, typically, where you pick up the rock and I didn't see this under there, right? And you're dealing with that. So first thing I needed to do was to win hearts and minds, because I needed people to give me a chance to be able to make some. This was not like a, oh, give me a week and we'll all be together. You know, this was going to be a slog. And so winning hearts and minds was really what was on my mind. And I'm a big believer in servant leadership. And so coming in, it was talking to people to say, listen, I know this isn't what you signed up for. When you joined the company, this is not what you expected, right? But because of what you've done so far, right? Here's what we can do. And here's what I see. And so it was really that kind of, element to put together. So once I got hearts and minds together, stemmed some bleeding, had some breathing room to be able to go figure out the problem, right? With everybody's help that we could go solve.
That's amazing. That's awesome. That's awesome. So when you are, you know, so you've written about not the work-life balance so much, but, you know, as you were mentioning before, the integration, right? And the integrating of work and marriage and parenthood, that which you have done successfully throughout your career. There's no doubt that challenges are substantially greater for women, even today. They should be far less, but they are there. Focusing on our listeners who are women and possibly as ambitious as you are, and if they're either in the early stages of their career or at the point where the balancing act seems more like a Cirque du Soleil routine than a regular workday, what practical advice can you offer them where they can begin to apply that advice right after listening to this?
So first is take help. Take help. We feel we have to do so much of this in terms of all by ourselves. And the answer is you don't. And when I say take help, I mean, you have kids, the whole bit. A three-year-old knows their colors. A three-year-old can actually separate laundry. You'd be amazed. So everybody pitches in. This is not all on you. So that's number one. Use the financial flexibility or create some financial flexibility. You know, my biggest advice to some people is, listen, even if it's just two evenings a week, the witching hours are for any family with children are typically from the time you get home until the kids go to bed, right? And if they're little, so let's call that, 6 o'clock to 8 or 8:30, witching hour. Everything's got to get done. Fed, bathed, cleaned, homework, right? It's witching hour. Fine. Hire a high school student. Hire a high school student to come in 6 to 8:30. What do they do? Whatever you don't want to do. That's what they do. If you just want to sit on the floor and play blocks, then let them heat up some food, right? In terms of put the lunch boxes together, right? So get help. Realize that your sanity is important for your family and for your career. So invest, I see it as investing in yourself by taking help.
I think that's such great advice. My daughter is 26 years old and she's a young mom and a young wife and has a career. I helped pay for someone to come in and do that for her, because I felt that that was important enough for her sanity to have someone come in for a couple hours every day to do exactly what you just talked about. And it makes a huge difference in her life. I mean, she and I talk about the fact that but for that, sometimes she'd literally lose her mind. I think it's such good advice. And the challenge is, I think for some people, and I'm obviously not a woman, but I have lived with them for many years, is women oftentimes, maybe because it's societal, maybe because it's inherent, feel like they need to do it all. And if they don't, they're somehow failing. And I think that part of the equation is to come up with a different way to think about what makes you a superhero. It isn't being able to do everything. That is not the mark of a superhero. That's the mark of someone that is maybe a martyr, but that's not what it's about. I think your advice is well taken. What is it in their mindset that you might be able to suggest that people shift?
Yes. The biggest thing to shift is your willingness to be judged on everything. And what I mean by that is we live in a very judgmental world. You just talked about that. So if we let it, the world will judge us on everything. And if we accept that judgment, then we feel we have to do everything. We don't have to accept the judgment, right? And so what I tell people is decide what you want to be judged on and focus on that. The rest of it, let it go. And while that sounds really easy, all right, I did it and you can do it. When my little girl was born, right, she had thick, thick, curly hair. I mean, really thick, curly hair. So the best way to keep her looking neat was you brush, combed, you part, you plaited, you put little bows, right, the whole bit. Did my late husband, all 6'2", big hands, former football player, did he know how to part and braid and plait and put little? No. Did he have to learn? Yes. So what did that mean? That meant that for about a month or so, when she went off to school, her hair was all jacked up. I mean, she had crooked parts. She had one thick braid, one thin, something uncoming. I mean, she looked a mess. All right. So fine. She gets to school. And you know for a fact, people are looking at her going, where's her mother? How did they let her look out of the house looking like that? Right? I didn't care. I did not accept that judgment. They don't know us. They don't know what's important to us. My husband needed to learn. And you only learn through practice. In 2 months, she was looking great and he was just fine. And did it affect her self-esteem? She was going to preschool. She's 3, 4 years old. What are we talking about here? So the point is, decide what you're willing to be judged on and let go of the rest. It doesn't matter. People spend far less time thinking about us than we think they spend thinking about us. Mm-hmm. So don't worry about it. Decide, let go. And that's the way you do it. Because otherwise, you're right, Tal. You do everything. Oh my God, my house has got to be perfect. My clothes have to be perfect. My kids have to be perfect. My husband has to be perfect. This has to be perfect. And you drive yourself nuts. It does not have to be perfect.
That's sage advice. Absolutely sage advice. And you know, I hope that our listeners, male and female, really, really internalize that. I think, you know, and I'm going down this path a little bit longer because I want to ask you your opinion about how, if you are in a relationship, whether you're a man or a woman, and your partner struggles with that, struggles with being concerned what other people think and struggling with not being perfect and not getting everything done, how can you best help them? I mean, what would be your advice? I mean, this isn't, you know, it's another angle of leadership, right? I mean, leadership is about leading people to the right outcomes. And within relationships, sometimes you're the leader and sometimes you're the follower. In those moments where maybe you have a partner that's really struggling with that, do you have any advice there? Mm.
It's almost a matter of trying to shine the mirror, you know, show the mirror in a certain way. And what I mean by that is when they feel that everything's important, oh no, I can't go because I've got to make sure that every little bit of dust is off this house. I mean, whatever it happens to be, right? Then it's the question. It's like, really? What will happen if that's not done? What will happen? And what's the implication on whatever's important to you? Hopefully in every family of what's important, your health, right? Safety of your kids, the whole bit. So go against those. So what really is it? Okay. And then if it has to do with, you know, something else in terms of skills or whatever they're building, what I tell people all the time is it's important to strengthen the things you're already strong at, because that's what you're known for. People are going to hire you because you're really good at project management. They're not going to hire you because you're okay at maybe doing spreadsheets. So don't spend a ton of time becoming an expert in spreadsheet. Other people can do that for you, right? So that's the other way to think about it. You know, if it's skill-based, focus on your strengths. If it's just trying to do everything because you're afraid of how you're being judged, what's the real implication, right? Just talk it through in terms of how does this really matter?
This is all fantastic. It really is. I feel actually really honored to be able to just sit here and listen to all this advice, because it really is not only sage, as Tal mentioned, but it's just so true, you know, and especially when you're going through something, whether it be something that's beyond your control, right? A family health crisis or something like that. At the end of the day, no one cares. Right? You just have to do what you have to do. And just to your point, if your child goes to school with, you know, lopsided hairdo or whatever, who cares? Because they don't matter anyway. What matters is the kid comes home safe and that the family is happy and that everyone's well fed and everyone's trying to better their lives together. That's the most important thing. And so thank you for going down that path. I really appreciated that.
Absolutely.
Well, I know we only have you for a couple more minutes, PJ. I think maybe we should definitely want to make sure we get to the last question that we wanted to ask today, which was about the future. So just given Shelley's time, maybe let's finish there.
Sure. Absolutely. So
go ahead.
Okay. So we, you know, Tal and I discussed, we read about your, on Bloomberg, about the, while only 6% of S&P's 500 CEOs are under 50, almost 30% of newly appointed of the CEOs are under 50. So we clearly have a new generation of leaders rising in corporate America. And some of those, some of our listeners may be those future CEOs, right? So what would you say are the most important qualities or skills that aspiring leaders should develop so that they are ready if and when that opportunity arises?
The first is, frankly, clarity. The ability to communicate clearly so that people truly understand what you are trying to communicate. I can't tell you how many companies things just spin and cycle because there isn't clarity on what the strategy is or what they're supposed to do or where the priorities are. And so therefore people make it up. So clarity is super important. Two, caring. And I know this is going to sound probably a little odd, but I believe at the end of the day, every individual wants to know that you care about them because they want to be cared about. I mean, your spouse or your partner can say, oh, I love you. But if they're not doing anything that actually shows it,
lip service.
You don't feel cared. No, you don't feel cared for. And we deep down want to feel that somebody cares. So leadership, a lot of it is, and it's so powerful, is just caring about the people that work for you and making sure they feel it and know it, right? In some way. And it's not words, it's actions. So clarity, caring, and the other is being authentic so that they can trust you. Because if you're not authentic, it just, they this won't trust you. People can tell, they feel authenticity. So be who you are, whoever that happens to be, would be the other thing that I would say. So I'm talking more in terms of attributes, right? Of what I think are important to be successful. But those three to me are pretty foundational.
So all of those three, I wholeheartedly agree with. And I think that they are universal. And I think that they are sort of evergreen. Is there anything that you think is different under the sun? I mean, we're entering, you know, I mean, I think the fact that we are suddenly seeing an influx of much younger CEOs, and I just turned 50, so I'm out of that equation. But I am curious, what is going to be different, if anything? Everything you cited, I think, is 100% true. And frankly, there's a reason it's true. It's because it's been proven to work. CEOs that have been successful, of course, there are always examples to the contrary of people that have succeeded despite being tyrants. But that is, you know, they are exceptions, and we should aspire to be far closer to the leaders that we would want to work for than the leaders we wouldn't. Is there anything you think is new under the sun, though? Is there anything that really emerges for you as that is a new way that a future CEO is going to have to think about things?
Right. I think the velocity of change is increasing. And because the velocity of change is increasing, you need leaders who are actually more open to change. You need leaders who are more open to technology. Every business is now a technology business. It's just that some companies realize it and some don't. So all of that, maybe what's driving, if you will, younger people who maybe are more open to new ideas as well as to technology in terms of where it's going to drive. But I think the velocity of change will cause a lot of disruption in the traditional ways in which we've run and managed our businesses.
That Amazing. Sounds right, and it sounds fair. Our guest today was the incredible Shelly Archambault. I don't know how to say her last name, and PJ did it so perfectly.
Archambault.
Okay. We covered some things that I did not expect to cover. We actually, it turns out that you both are in favor of eating your children and child labor of 3 years. things that, you know, I've seen you on CNN and CNBC. I've never heard you say those things, and I think it would be slightly controversial. But other than that, everything you said today was, absolutely, I think, wisdom of the highest order. And I hope that people who listen to you or watched this episode recognize just how much value there is in absorbing what Shelly shared today. There is, in fact, maybe not a connect the dots approach to succeeding as a CEO or in life, but there are things you can do that are going to exponentially increase your odds of doing it and being happy in the process. And I think we heard Shelly articulate that today.
And super
Shelly,
quick,
thank you so much. Yeah go ahead,
super
PJ.
Super quick. First of all, Shelly, please come back. Please mm-hmm. come back. We want you to come back not only because you are a delight and you just dropped a whole bunch of knowledge bombs on us, but also the fact that we know that you are launching something that you're very excited about. Can you give us a real quick window into this passion project, or I don't know if it's a passion project, but this thing that you are super excited about launching? Can you please share?
Absolutely. And thanks so much for asking. And I'd be happy to come back. So I'm launching Ignite Ambition, which is a nonprofit, and it's focused on providing wisdom, inspiration, knowledge, tangible, tactical tools that you can use to try to improve your overall ability to achieve your aspirations. And we're targeting people who are in their early to mid-stage of career, because so many companies don't have the resources anymore to actually invest. And I'll call it the professional development. And too many people hit a road bump or a career hurdle they don't know how to deal with, and it just derails them. Yeah. And I find that to be just awful. So there aren't enough mentors in this world for everybody to have one-on-one mentors. So I'm trying to provide mentoring advice at scale. And that's through Ignite Ambition. Thank you very much for letting me talk about that a little bit. Just follow me. LinkedIn, Instagram, all those things. You can find out more information.
Is there a website that they can go to?
Shelly.com.
Shelly. Wow. There you go.
But it's spelled Y-E, right?
Y-E. That's right. Yeah, so Shelly.
S-H-E-L-L-Y-E. .com. And we're going to have that in the show notes. So for anybody who's interested in reaching out to Shelly, you could do that that way. PJ, thank you for remembering that. I'm really grateful that you did, because that was a very, very important thing that I wanted to make sure that we did cover. Thank you for giving Shelly the opportunity to do that.
Of course.
Shelly, thank you again. It was a great pleasure. And indeed, we hope to have you as a guest again in the not too distant future.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard, want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook, visit us on YouTube, and please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.